see Abdullah ibn Imam Hassan al-Islam, who was just about 11 and a half years old on the day of Ashura. And we see that he was the last shaheed before Imam Hussein al-Islam, even the shaheed after Al-Hazrat Ali al-Asghar al-Islam, according to the history, according to what we see. So we can see like he was a teen, yeah? So we see that a teen is the one like still supporting the Imam until his last breath.
Right.
So the Imam is in the ditch and the enemy wants to kill him like any moment. And at that time, a teen is the one, not an adult. A teen is the one who is coming still forward to support and protect his imam. So right. Abdullah ibn Imam Hussein al-Islam, who was eventually, of course, he got martyred in front of the eyes of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. Another example, Hazrat Ali Akbar alayhi salam. We see him as a beautiful example who was Ashbahun Nas li Rasulih. So the one who was extremely, I would say, like very near to Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, with regards to his face, his expressions, his talking methodology,
right.
His thinking even, yeah? So it's not just, oh, you know what? He used to look like Rasulullah. No, it's not just, it's also his thinking and his speaking methodology. Everything was near to Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. Of course, he's not an imam, but he's a teen. And we can see these qualities in Hazrat Ali al-Akbar, alayhi salatu wassalam.
Right.
So, and also another example, what we see on the day of Ashura, again, with this dimension of tarbiyah, is if a person does tarbiyah properly towards his son or daughter, a teen, and there were other daughters like who are teenagers, on right. the day of Ashura again, who sacrificed everything what they had after the day of Ashura, after the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. So it's not just the son who went ahead into the battlefield. We saw the daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam delivering speeches, sermons on the way to Kufa and also in Kufa.
Right.
So yeah.
We'll discuss more with you, brother, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing on IRIB English Radio. Brother Liaqat is with us. So, Brother Liaqat, you were saying that on the day of Ashura, the way the teens were nurtured, it showed up in that event and it remained a lesson for the generations. You said there were not only boys who were teens who fought in the battlefield, but the women, but the teens, the teenage girls who were there present in this event, they also fought the wars with their words.
Exactly. I would say with regards to the teenagers who were girls, how they used to protect the hijab, if right. we see. Example, the daughters of Imam Hussein al-Islam. Of course, the adults are adults.
Right.
They have a lot of experience. Their knowledge is much more than the teens, isn't it? But even the teens who were there on the day of Ashura, they cried when their veils were snatched away. So this shows something like with regards to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu wassalam, when some Islamic wajib or something which is wajib upon a person is being snatched away from the person is crying aloud, crying out by saying, my right has been snatched away from
right.
me. Being a teenager again.
Right.
And this was the upbringing of the parents, how they brought up their children, that this is being shown on the day of Ashura. Even we see this with a 3.5-year-old girl when her hijab was snatched away and she asked her aunt, like, oh, my dear aunt Zainab, salamu alayha, I want my veil back from the enemies. Then we see Sayyidah Zainab replying to her by saying, Ammati Mislok, your aunt is also just like you. Even I don't have a veil.
Right.
So you see, like, so it's like this is shown even in a small child who is just 3.5, 4 years old.
Right.
This is shown even in a teenager, and this is shown in adulthood as well. So the impact of upbringing, how we upbring our children. You see, like, again, it goes back to how we are speaking to them. How are we showing love towards them? Yeah. How are we valuing their words? And what teachings are we giving to them? Everything matters over here.
Right.
And, of course, like, where are they standing? With whom are they going? With whom are they coming back? Who are their friends? You see, everything matters.
Of course, everything has an impact.
Exactly. So...
The way you have brought up the issue of hijab over here, how these little girls and teenage girls and adults were concerned about their hijabs in the times of calamity, in the times of tragedy, because in this tragic situation, they could have just one excuse, like we were being looted from all the sides, so we had no way out, and like we had no other choice. But this being restless, this restlessness shows another modesty that they are veiled with. And the same is shown in the life of Lady Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha, that has personally helped me to observe more hijab. It's like when I heard the event of, like, she is being with Lady Fezza on a window and they are watching a funeral is being taken. And then it's very obvious the funeral that the men were carrying was a funeral of a woman. And then Lady Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha says to Fezza, "Oh Fezza, when I die, first of all, I should be buried in the night time, and second, construct me a tabut. So construct me a tabut when I should not be, it should not be obvious, like, is there a male inside this or a female inside this?" So that's the, I would say, intensity
Indeed.
Of hijab or being worried about. And because after death, nobody is going to ask you. And when you are in a tragic situation, in a calamity, nobody is going, you're not accountable or you're not answerable. But yet, we see this is the upbringing.
Indeed.
That has
this
shown.
Happens when the upbringing is embedded.
Right.
It's completely like dissolved in the soul.
Right.
Yep.
We'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, Allah will write a reward for he who kisses his child, and Allah will bring happiness on Judgment Day to he who makes his child happy.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is with us, and we are discussing the impact that remains on the teenagers and the children of any age when they are brought up very carefully. Yes, brother. You were mm-hmm. giving us the examples.
So exactly. So I would say it's not a forceful impact upon a child. It's an impact which is embedded in a child or a teen, example. Of course, it starts from childhood and it shows more color when the child turns into a teenager, and it shows more colors when the child goes into his or her adulthood. So as the process of growth, the physical growth goes ahead, even the showing of colors of the teachings and the upbringing of the person or the child shows more colors.
Right.
So these are the teachings from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and also from Amirul Mu'mineen. Of course, they would have beautiful discussions among themselves, isn't it? And in fact, when Sayyida Zahra salamu alayha, when she got married to Amirul Mu'mineen, she was just a teenager. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So over here we see four dimensions from the life of Sayyida Fatima, and one of the dimensions what we see from her life is the life of being a daughter towards her father. She
right.
is a teen, and how does a teen shows respect towards her father, isn't
it? Right.
Another dimension is a teen showing her love and affection towards her husband.
Right.
And a teen showing her love and affection towards the children. And a teen all by herself, Sayyidatin Nisa al-Alameen. She became Sayyidatin Nisa al-Alameen in her teenagehood, isn't
right.
it? When she was a
Reaching
teenager.
This level.
Exactly. She was called, she is the Sayyidatin Nisa al-Alameen min al-Awwaleen wal-Akhireen. She's the leader of all the women of the whole existence from the start till the last. So she was just a teen, meaning a teenager can reach a value, a stage where he or she is called the leader of all the women. Or over here we see Sayyida Shabab al-Jannah, where he is called the leader or master of the youths of paradise, Imam Hassan alayhi salam and Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. So this is what a teen has achieved during her teenagehood,
right.
isn't it? So
teens have this capability to reach spiritual heights. So dear teens, stop giving us excuses like I'm rebellious because I'm a teen, I am rude because I'm a teen, and I'm just going through these hormonal imbalances and all the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam, they were all brought to earth in the form of human beings, and they went through all those phases that we go through, and
Indeed.
The difficult times that they have gone through, we have never seen that difficult time ever in the history. Thank you so much, Brother Liaquat, for being with us. That was
Thank
our today's
you.
Episode. Dear listeners, if you had any questions or queries, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. If you want to listen to our episodes again, go back to our official website. There's www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and you can go there and you'll find an archive of our programs there. Thank you for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Soba International Media Festival.
Part 2.
Comedy. What is it? And does it even have a place in today's world that's been afflicted with the pains of death and destruction as a result of war? Can this genre of dramatic literature that deals with the serious in a satirical manner tickle the mind and wake us up from political slumber? This is Sob, and I'm your host, Hassan Tabakoli.
One of Ireland's finest comedians, Tadhg Hickey, has a one-of-a-kind way of educating people on politics and giving them a fresh perspective on how to view the world around them. I sat down with Tadhg to have a chat about his entertaining yet powerful political activity that focuses on both domestic Irish politics, especially Irish reunification, and international politics, in particular, the issue of Palestine.
Hi, Kiki. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to see you again.
Well, you've done comedy about Palestine. Regarding Irish politics, you've also done some comedic acts. The hot topic discussed nowadays in Ireland, the whole of Ireland, is the issue of reunification, many say. And perhaps Ireland, the whole of Ireland, will reach that stage one day. We don't know. But first of all, the issue of reunification, how significant is this issue to you?
I would say before the genocide in Gaza, it was the main focus of my attention. As I say, I didn't come from a particularly political background, but from the time that I started reading in school, I felt that I had an understanding of the North that wasn't the traditional understanding in the South, that there were no monsters in the North, that there were reasons why the IRA felt compelled to initially defend their community and to try and liberate the six counties of the North. Again, in the current climate, I think we're getting a new, nuanced understanding of these labels like terrorist versus freedom fighter and where you kind of stand and all that. I suppose, because I read a bit, and I developed friendships with people in the north. I understood just what they went through, pre-Troubles and post-Troubles, and I felt a kinship with them, and I wanted to buck the trend that you would get in the north of, as I was saying to you, this kind of disconnect on all sorts of levels. People in Cork and Dublin generally wouldn't, and it's even the same today, it's improving a little bit, but you could get people in the south of Ireland that have travelled to Dubai and Australia and America, and they mightn't have been to Belfast. So that's the level of disconnect. And I don't blame the people. We had a lot of really strong, sophisticated propaganda to tell us in the south by the political elite and the media elite, don't go there, it's dangerous, it has nothing to do with us, we wish they would just stop it, it's embarrassing us. That was kind of the climate that I grew up in. So
my who do you mostly blame for this disconnection?
I would blame the political elite in the south of Ireland. I mean, we have the Irish Times and the Irish Independent and RTE were run by people, and the nicest thing I could say about them was that they had a vested interest in continuing partition. You know, they had a nice little kind of fiefdom of their own in the south, and they didn't want the trouble of the north, and they didn't want to recognise their own abdication of responsibility for the north. So the south played a huge role in the disconnect and the troubles in the north, because it was never there for its brethren. One of the beautiful things about Irish solidarity with Palestine at the moment is a friend of mine who'd be a Republican, and he's a little bit older now, said it's great to see the solidarity with Palestine because we never showed it to our own people. We never showed it to our own people when they needed it. And Sean will obviously be able to tell you a lot more about that. But I think, to go back to your question, I became interested very young. And then you understand the role of colonialism, and you understand the bitterness and the violence and all that kind of stuff. And then you need to get to a point where you look ahead. And the republicanism that I'm interested in has always looked ahead and not to the past. And building a future for Ireland, as I say, that's going to take the best of what we've got in both jurisdictions, and it's going to build something new. And that building something new as well is going to not just be Catholics and Protestants. There's people of all faiths in Ireland now. They need to be represented, and they need to be made feel that Ireland is a welcoming place. There's no point in the likes of me advocating for Palestinians or Arab people, you know, in their own countries. We need to make sure that the Arabs and foreigners, for want of a better word, feel very welcome and feel like Ireland is their home if they want it to be, and they have every equal opportunity to somebody who has been born in Ireland and reared in Ireland.
We'll be right back after this short break. Stay tuned.
Oh, bother. Not this again.
Yeah, this again. For the umpteenth time, can you please give me back the things you stole from me?
Wow, no hi, how are you or anything?
Firstly, I didn't steal them, did I? I acquired them.
All right, how?
Oh, by burning your house down and taking them without your consent. Yeah, I know, but if you don't mind me saying, it's a little bit provocative to call that quote-unquote theft. Yeah, words matter, friend. And anyway, that was a long time ago. Back then, I just didn't realise that you were a human being with rights, values and feelings like me. And that's my bad. But I'm a different person now.
Well, Ireland was the very first imperial project, if you want to say, by the British Empire. Over 800 years ago, they invaded this island. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the remnants of that British colonialism would be the DUP party today in the north of Ireland. Do you see parallels between nationalists versus the DUP and Palestinians versus the Israelis? What parallels do you see?
I kind of feel like, and obviously I'm biased, I suppose, right? So I'll try and give as less a biased answer as possible. I feel like Irish Republicans and Irish nationalists, their relationship with Palestine is very long. You know, it's a rich tradition of understanding each other. Both freedom groups of freedom fighters have been on hunger strike, for instance. There's a Palestinian friend of mine told me recently that when Palestinians go on hunger strike, they call it an Irish strike or a Bobby Sands strike, or, you know, so there's a rich history and understanding between Irish republicanism, Irish nationalists and Palestine. It's not all, but it seems to me that some of the unionist, British unionist or British loyalist support for Israel, for instance, would be about which side are you guys supporting, or we'll take the other one. You know, so it's a provocative move that doesn't necessarily have, I think, the same level of history or the same level of empathy or understanding. You even have some loyalists at the moment supporting Israel. In this most, I would say, difficult moment to support Israel, they're still quite openly supporting a country that's effectively on trial for genocide. So there's something about Palestine, though, and you can see it in the Palestinian community in Ireland right now, because I'm at many events where Palestinians and Irish are together, they're performing together, they're sitting together. It really is the most extraordinary symbiotic relationship. And in fact, Daniel Mate, who is a psychotherapist, he's the son of Gabor Mate, he recently visited Ireland and I spent some time when we did a comedy sketch together. And unprompted, he said that as well. He said, I've never seen anything so bizarre in my life that, you know, an Irish person goes up, sings a little bit in Arabic, sings a bit in Irish, sings a bit in English, and then a Palestinian gets up, sings their bit. The songs seem to have a relationship with each other, you know, because it's the same struggle. I believe it's the same struggle. And the one thing that I'm very proud about Ireland is that our solidarity with Palestine, it seems to transcend ethnicity, religion, because people sometimes think, oh, why would we support them? They're not like us. They don't look like us. They don't have the same skin colour. They're not Catholic, you know. But I think because of our colonial past, it's in our DNA. When we see people being dehumanised, that's us. We went through the same thing. When there's cartoons in the Washington Post dehumanising Palestinians, we remember Punch magazine, when the British used to depict us as simian and lawless and prone to violence. And when we particularly see a population being deliberately starved in an attempt to commit genocide or ethnic cleansing, something in us, I think, something in our DNA, something in the very marrow of our being recognises it and feels like if we don't stand up for Palestine, we're not standing up for ourselves. We're not standing up for our past. So I would say it's a rich, deep spiritual connection. And I would argue that the loyalist connection to Israel it's opportunistic. And yeah, I better say enough because I'm loaded with loyalist trolls, so I don't want to create another generation of them for myself.
What does your family say about the recent comedy you're doing now?
You know, they're very supportive. Sadly, my parents are passed away.
God bless them.
Yeah, and I feel like my mom actually would have some concerns because she was a bit of a worrier. And I mean, the reality is that whatever about the effects of my career, there are some pretty mean people who would probably like to see me certainly fail in my career, if not much worse. And that would be a cause of concern for my mother. My sister obviously worries a little bit as well. But my partner, my daughter, I have an older daughter and a younger daughter. My older daughter and my sister, my extended family, I think at the start they would have been concerned for me only on the level of perhaps my own mental health. Because this is horrific. I mean, what Palestinians are going through, I genuinely wouldn't even be able to imagine. And even what allies are going through, because of the stuff that we're watching and you feel at times like you're knocking your head against a wall. So only on that level were they concerned for me. But I think, again, because the mowing the lawn has gone on so long that I found by month two or three, a lot of my family members and friends were joining me at marches, were being extremely supportive of what I was doing. And they weren't even looking at me in many ways. They were off doing their own things as well. Many of my friends, you know, have stood up and they've been counted during this period. And sadly, without being negative, I have to say there's definitely been some friends of mine and there have been some colleagues of mine. I cannot believe that they've seen what they've seen and they haven't stood up and said anything and used maybe their platform or their resources to do something. And it speaks to just this kind of underbelly of racism in the West. I mean, there's no way addressing it up. There's a kind of a white supremacy and a racist thinking in the West that some people are very aware of and they embrace, and other people are not so aware of it, but by God, it's there. Because there's no way that friends of mine, I feel, would witness white people being murdered in those numbers, starved to death in those numbers, and would sit silently at home doing their own thing that they were doing. No way.
Well, as a comedian with a courageous passion to, you know, question the hypocritical mainstream media, what challenges do you face that other people in your line of work do not?
I mean, first and foremost, the challenge is censorship. So that's what we're going through at the moment, all of us. Palestinians, by the way, you're probably well aware, are going through this on a much greater level. Because I'm white and I'm from the West, I'll get away with more. But I've still had my TikTok account cancelled. Subsequently, I was reinstated. I didn't do anything. I have no idea what's going on TikTok, to be honest. I get sketches removed all the time. I've gotten banned. Then I get put back up. Instagram is one of the most insidious ones. They give you warnings and they restrict the viewers on your sketches. They put, you know, they put you down the list or whatever. The algorithm punishes you. Because sometimes I would share sketches, again, from Palestinians. So Palestinians would sometimes message me saying, can you share this because I've been banned? I have to set up a new account and I will share it. And I get slaps on the wrist for sharing content from the genocide. So the people committing the genocide seem to be acting with relative impunity, and the people reporting it are getting cancelled and restricted online. So I think it's really insidious on Instagram, and it's tough because my main source of activism is online. My main source is social media, and many people are in the same situation. Yet you have to deal with these companies where you have to toe the line to a certain extent. Having said that, I actually have not really towed the line that much. I still post what I want to post. A lot of the stuff that I do is satire. So if you're going to take down satire, which has happened, it has happened. If you're going to take down satire, you're basically, you know, trying to cancel an ancient form of responding to power. Satire is as old as time itself. So the censorship is the worst one, because I don't mind my sketches being lifted. I'm honoured when my sketches get lifted and get translated into Arabic and Farsi and other languages. That is an absolute honour. But I want my message to get out there, because, I mean, I'm kind of committing most of my time to it at the moment. So it would be very frustrating for the message not to get out there. And sometimes I'll post a sketch and it won't get any views anywhere near what it usually would, because I'm being so restricted, or you get like shadow banned and all these kind of things. I think when the dust settles, it's not the primary thing, but when the dust settles, these big tech companies should answer for the tech fascism and censorship that they have unleashed on Palestinians in their moment of need. I think it's morally repugnant what they've done. And the other things I'd face is that there's people online, you know, trying to garner support to get my gigs cancelled. I haven't had any corporate work in the last kind of 7 or 8 months. I used to get regular voiceover work. We spoke about the voiceover. I mean, good voiceover work is very important for my, or was certainly very important for my income, and it like dried up 2 weeks after October 7th. No auditions, no emails. And again, that speaks to the kind of way that Ireland is pro-Palestine in terms of the people, but the media class are very beholden to US interests. So now I would say that I don't wish to be whiny, because I'm being supported both spiritually and emotionally, but also financially. I have a Patreon account. I have a PayPal. Most of my subscribers and patrons are from the Arab world, and I love that. Patreon is like a little love-in, if people don't know it. It's like a social media platform where no one's nasty. Everyone's kind of really interested in you and your life, and I do...
And supportive.
Supportive, and they really get what you're doing. I get messages there all the time from people saying, you know, I'm second generation Irish or second generation Palestinian, and to see your content, it made a difference. And I do an Ask Me Anything once a month, and I get well paid there, actually. I have more than enough to get by. It mightn't have been as much money as I was making beforehand, but, you know, I'm not trying to make myself out to be a hero, but it's not about money. Like, we're in the middle of a genocide, you know what I mean? So some things are more important.
Yeah. There's another sketch of you.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So, guys, what we're talking about is if somebody's using unreasonable force against you, you have the right to fight back to protect yourself.
Yes, so say he's been bullying me for years. I have the right to give him a few smacks then, do I?
No, that's terrorism.
Huh? If he does hit me back, though, I have the right to kick him to death then, don't I?
Yes, but be surgical with the kicks.
Are you for real?
Listen, pal, I don't make the rules.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, yeah.
He hit me the other week, so it's okay if I hit him back, yeah?
Weirdly, no. That would be an unprovoked attack.
Are you high?
Why?
Because I don't like you.
You know what? This class is a load of
Why me? Well, I'm so lovely and I never do anything to anyone. Let's kill him, Dad.
I've created a monster.
Speaks a lot. I've created a monster. I mean, speaks a lot about what's really happening today, yeah.
Thank you. If I do say so myself, I'm quite happy with that sketch because I feel it packs a lot in.
It does,
packs the idea of the monster, the creating the monster, but also just the double standards is there for everyone to see.
In that sketch, yeah, you say...
Yeah.
You say, who makes the rules? Yeah, you said, I don't make the rules. And that's the question to who makes the rules.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I think America has shown unequivocally in the last few months that international law, rules-based order, that's a joke. That's definitely a joke. There's one rule for the West and Western allies, and then there's another rule for everyone else. The West are the goodies, Iran, Russia, China, because they don't play the game with America, are by definition then baddies. And I feel like, particularly young people, they're waking up to all that stuff now.
Speaking about young people, what would your piece of advice be to aspiring, artists who want to follow your line of work and especially take the bold decision to, do such courageous acts of comedy?
Thank you for saying it's courageous. You know, the way I feel about it, again, is to go back to being true to yourself. You know, I see friends of mine who they might necessarily work in the arts, but they just work in jobs that they don't really feel like they're being true to themselves. And they always get unhappy. Now, you can still get unhappy by being true to yourself, but I find there's just something about doing exactly what you want to do, that there's a kind of a joy in it that I think is very rewarding. And I kind of feel with young people as well, it's, you know, do something that you enjoy for sure, but also do some reading. Do some reading, like get into the idea of, and I think they're doing it anyway. I don't need to tell them because, you know, I've got a daughter who's 20 and that generation, I think they're going to sort the world out, to be honest with you. If you look at talking about courage, the kids, which is obviously in a derogatory way of describing them, the young people in American universities right now, like the stuff that they have to lose, they could lose their careers, literally, by the advocacy that they're doing. And they're not taking the easy option. They're not thinking of money. They're not thinking of the careers. They're standing up for what's right. They obviously have done the reading. And that's a big thing for me. It's if I hadn't have picked up a history book and certainly gone to the North, for instance, and spoke to people, better again, speak to people who've grown up in that area, like coming to Iran.
First-hand information.
I have... All I can gather about Iran is the kind of stuff that I've read personally, obviously, and whatnot. But I grew up with Western propaganda, and it's hard. Like, Western propaganda is a hell of a drug. It's hard to get all that out of your system. You got to go and you got to meet the people, and then you have new impressions. So my advice for people, for young people, would be do the reading, go and meet the people, make up your own mind. Don't swallow the propaganda. And if you're an artist and... you get interested in politics and you get interested in portraying the way the world perhaps actually works, there's nothing as joyful or gives you a stronger feeling of worth, actually, as an artist, than to fuse your skill set, your artistic skill set, with your beliefs, both about politics and about humanity, I think, really, in the case of Gaza right now. It's not even a political issue, is it? It's a human being issue.
So how supportive would you be if your daughters wanted to, follow you, comedy and all that?
Have they ever started something up?
Any interest, perhaps, yeah?
Yeah, I'd be definitely supportive. And I don't think I'd be one of those worrying... I don't worry, I worry about... I mean, I'm a crazy guy. I've got a background of mental illness and alcoholism. And I worry about stupid stuff. But I don't worry about being killed or I don't worry, like when I was coming over here, there's a massive ignorance about Iran in the West. And people who mean well would say, oh, be careful, that's a dangerous country. I've never been in a safer country in my life. I was in a gathering of like millions of people today. And I didn't get one cross word. Nobody pushed me. I wonder if I could say that about the West, even my own country. I don't think I would feel that safe. So, or sorry, if I was, you know, from another country or another ethnicity, I don't know would they feel so safe in Ireland. So, if my daughter, she's only one, my younger daughter, she's only one. I don't know what her ambitions are for the future, but if she wanted to advocate for oppressed people, and whether that was in comedy or human rights work or whatever, I would be especially proud of her, because that's the best thing I can think of doing with my time.
Okay, Tyke, at the end of the programme, every programme, we have this section where we request our guest to look into the camera and speak their mind about something that's really concerning to them.
The thing that's on my mind and is most concerning to me is, and for a long time now has been, Palestine. And my message is just to the wonderful activists all over the world, the students in the encampments, the Palestine solidarity groups all over the world, the tribe that we've built during this horrific genocide. Let's keep that tribe together so that we pursue Palestine and its needs, right to liberation, justice and statehood. And let's stay together as a tribe and build a mass movement for anti-imperialist causes all over the world. We have the power when we stand together. The people always do. Thank you.
Thanks, Tyke. And we thank our guest, Tyke Hickey from Ireland, for taking part in this programme. Until another programme, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team, is goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The late leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement said Hassan Nasrallah has ensured that Hezbollah will forever be a thorn in the side of the Israeli regime, and the struggle shall continue until the liberation of the occupied Palestinian territories. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. It has been over 40 days since Hezbollah resistance movement leader and revered icon of the axis of resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, attained martyrdom after decades of struggle. Throughout more than a year of relentless American-Israeli genocidal war against Gaza, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, without a shade of a doubt, demonstrated his unwavering courage and commitment to the Palestinian cause and literally walked the talk. At a time when Arab leaders were still bamboozled and unsure about how to react, said Hassan Nasrallah ordered his resistance fighters to join Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on 8th of October. Years ago, when the US offered security guarantees to Hezbollah in exchange for the Lebanese resistance movement severing its ties with the Palestinians, he resolutely responded, "You offer us security while Palestine, its people, Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque have no security. Damn you and damn your security guarantees." This declaration came almost 24 years ago, soon after Hezbollah had famously forced Israeli occupation forces out of Lebanon. Other Arab leaders, except for Syria, fell into these so-called security assurances. The late Hezbollah leader noted almost a decade ago, "The Americans even informed us that you can continue backing the Palestinians and their resistance in public. That's why you hear some Arab rulers publicly supporting the Palestinians." Today, following the year-long genocidal war in Gaza, which has massacred nearly 43,700 Palestinians, said Hassan Nasrallah's words resonate more powerfully than ever before. But he left behind more than wise words. He left a Lebanese resistance movement that has made him and many around the world incredibly proud with their pro-Palestine operations. The current Israeli war on Lebanon surpasses even the 2006 war, which lasted 33 days. Back then, Israeli occupation forces penetrated more than 10 kilometers into Lebanese territory. Though Hezbollah had planned ambushes within Lebanese territory, forcing the occupying forces to retreat quickly from towns like Beit Jebel. Now, nearly a month and a half into another attempted ground invasion of Lebanon, the Israeli occupation forces are merely shifting meters at the border, failing to secure a single Lebanese village. On at least three occasions since last September, Hezbollah has successfully repelled Israeli forces at the strategic village of Al-Khiyam, leaving the occupation humiliated. This costly stalemate has compelled Israel to seek indirect political negotiations, although Lebanon remains uninvolved, with US envoy Hochstein absent from Beirut. It's a failed ground invasion by all measures, even admitted by the Israeli media themselves. Further evidence of defeat may be seen in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's unceremonious dismissal of Yoav Gallant, the war minister, pointing to increased fissures and disintegration within the regime. Unlike Netanyahu, Gallant, with his military background, recognized that a ground invasion of Lebanon was suicidal for Israeli troops, something that Netanyahu could not accept despite mounting Israeli military casualties at the border. Yoav Gallant also noted that Israel's setbacks in Gaza, particularly in the northern part of the blockaded territory around Jabalia, which continues to resist despite intense bombardment. Netanyahu isn't the only one unwilling to yield. Palestinians and Lebanese also remain defiant and resolute, unbowed by American-Israeli attempts to turn them against the resistance. The resistance in Gaza's north is deeply moving. Despite continuous bombings, Palestinians prefer to die in their homes rather than be forced to other areas and get burnt alive at a hospital shelter. A brave Palestinian woman declared, "I will use this white cloth as a shroud for my children, but never wave it as a flag of surrender." She spoke for all Palestinians and Lebanese. The Palestinian resistance continues to claim Israeli military casualties in Gaza despite heavy bombardment, a commitment that Hezbollah mirrors by maintaining its support for the besieged territory, its people and its resistance. Hezbollah's strength dispels any doubt about its future after Said Hassan Nasrallah's martyrdom. Nasrallah's leadership endures, with Hezbollah carrying forward his plans with renewed vigour and resolve. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The late Hezbollah leader Seyed Hassan Nasrallah said in one of his final speeches, "In any future war, if Israeli forces bomb Lebanon's power plants, airports and seaports, we will bomb your power plants, your airports and your seaports in occupied Palestine." Today, Hezbollah has put this formula into action, striking targets deep inside the occupied Haifa port and Ben Gurion airport. With each move, Hezbollah stays a step ahead, said Hassan Nasrallah, vowed unbreakable and unshakable support for Gaza, a promise that Hezbollah has kept more than 40 days since his martyrdom. In his final speech, he declared, "No settlers will return to northern occupied Palestine until a ceasefire is reached in Gaza." Hezbollah's missiles have since forced even more settlers to depart. Importantly, Hezbollah has used only a fraction of its military resources, holding reserves for various scenarios, including potential US intervention. A contingency plan that Seyed Hassan Nasrallah himself prepared the Lebanese resistance to meet. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in a heartfelt and beautiful tribute to Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, declared, "My brother, my dear one, a source of pride for me." Seyed Hassan Nasrallah ensured that Hezbollah will forever be a thorn in the side of the Israeli regime and that the struggle shall continue until the liberation of all occupied territories. At this moment, Lebanon is facing a war of aggression unleashed by the heavily armed settler colonial regime that is dragging the entire region towards death and destruction. Today, Lebanon is being terrorized because the Lebanese resistance movement intervened in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. In fact, the small country of Lebanon is once again under attack from a nuclear-armed colonial regime that is enjoying enthusiastic military, political, economic, and ideological backing and unconditional protection from the United States and its proxies.
Today, the European Union is in serious trouble. The largest EU economies, those of France and Germany, are quite weak, and there seems to be little prospect of them improving materially anytime soon. A recent report by former ECB President Mario Draghi acknowledged that the EU suffers from uncompetitive levels of productivity. In addition, the EU's establishment political parties are rapidly losing votes to the left and the right, as happened recently in both France and Germany. Meanwhile, the war in Ukraine has become an epic debacle for the EU. Despite imposing severe sanctions on Russia and transferring huge quantities of weapons to the Zelensky regime, Ukraine's NATO-backed military is in retreat all over the battlefield. Despite the obvious signs of the EU's decline, there have been very few voices of dissent in the European Parliament, but one of those voices is that of Mick Wallace. Mick is an Irish politician. He served from 2019 to this year as a member of the European Parliament from Ireland for the South constituency. He is a member of Independence for Change and part of the left in the European Parliament, or was at least as a member of the Parliament up until earlier this year. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome you today, Mick. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Dimitri.
So, Mick, during your time in European Parliament, you gained international fame in the eyes of some, and I guess infamy in the eyes of others, depending on your political orientation, for your outspoken criticism of the EU's foreign policy. And for those who might not be familiar with your courageous stances, I certainly regard them as courageous, I wanted to show a video of one of your more notable exchanges in the EU Parliament. Earlier this year, you had a rather heated exchange with somebody by the name of Sarah Skittadal. She's a Swedish politician from the right-wing Christian Democrats. And I'd just like to share that exchange to our audience now.
I am deeply concerned about my Irish colleague from the left group. Anti-Semitism is on the rise throughout Europe, and an elected official continues to spread anti-Semitic messages. Also, this is a war that started because of terrorism, a war between a democratic state and a terrorist group. But in your upside-down world, you are calling the democratic state the terrorists, and not even mentioning the atrocities committed by Hamas. This, my dear colleagues, is a clear example of the batshit crazy left that does not belong in any elected chamber, let alone this one.
You're calling Israel a democratic state. Well, let me tell you something, right? But democratic states don't behave like an apartheid state. They don't commit collective punishment. They don't bomb hospitals, refugee camps, and people's homes. They don't commit genocide. Israel is not a democratic state. Stop telling that lie. And Jews all over the world are horrified at the Zionist state of Israel at the moment. And the Jews all over the world are gathering against Zionists.
So,
Mick, I found that to be a rather telling exchange. First of all, it looked to me like the president cut you off, shut down your microphone before you finished speaking. And he didn't do that to Skittadal. In fact, he allowed her to smear you and to refer to the left as batshit crazy, which I would have thought in a parliament is not consistent with the rules of decorum. Could you tell us what happened here and how you sort of view the whole way in which you were treated in that exchange?
Listen, it was no surprise to me as to how I was being treated. I had been speaking about the Palestinian issue, and she was allowed to blue card me. So, and that's allowed. That's part of the rules. So you can press a button and you can challenge someone, and you're allowed to ask them a question. Now, you're supposed to ask a question, not make a statement. But which he did, but you're allowed to ask a question, and then the person at the podium is allowed to answer that question, right? And now, you give, each are entitled to a certain amount of time. Now, it's possible I went over the time a little bit, although I'm not so sure, but the president does as he or she sees fit, and that there isn't any left-wing presidents in there, and they're mostly of a right-wing persuasion. And they don't really like to hear what I have to say about a lot of things because I don't agree with them. But listen, the parliament is probably 95% of a right-wing persuasion anyway. And to say there's 5% of the deputies left-wing, it might even be an exaggeration. So there's nothing surprising about if they agree with your narrative, then you're likely to get a little bit more time. If they don't like what you have to say, well, they're very, very strict with the time sometimes. But, I mean, that's life. I mean, it's like in the European Union for a number of years now, there's been a lot of talk about disinformation and propaganda. And what they're really saying is, if you say something that is not what we want you to say, then it gets labelled disinformation or it's labelled propaganda. Oh, you're a Russian puppet. If you're telling the truth, but it's not a truth that they like to hear, then they call it something else, like disinformation or propaganda.
I want to talk to you more broadly about the EU's policies towards Israel's genocidal regime. You know, we've had a determination from the International Court of Justice that it is plausible that Israel is committing genocide, and Israel will be tried one day for that. We've had the prosecutor of the ICC at The Hague requesting arrest warrants for the Israeli prime minister and defense minister, although it seems like it's taking an eternity for the court to decide whether to issue those arrest warrants. We just had a report from the UN that by destroying the healthcare system of Gaza, Israel has engaged in the crime against humanity of extermination. And I could go on and on and on. These are international institutions to which all EU member states are parties. And nonetheless, it appears to my eye that the EU remains fully behind the state of Israel. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has been, at least rhetorically, more and more critical, it seems, over the past few months of Israel. But in your view, has the EU taken any concrete steps to defend the rights of the Palestinian people or to hold Israel accountable since this genocide began?
No, zero. Some states, like Ireland, like Spain, have talked about things, but they've done nothing. Ireland says, oh, it's terrible what Israel is doing and is Palestine. And they always preface it as well with, oh, it was terrible what Hamas did, but now Israel should be more measured in how it responds. But the truth is, Ireland, like all the other European countries, has been supportive of the Zionism, the settler colonial project. Since an Irish minister was asked in May this year, how many dual-use weapons has Ireland sold to Israel since October 7th last year? At that time, we had sold 52 million euros worth of dual-use weapons to Israel. Why in God's name, if we care about the Palestinians in Ireland, why are we selling dual-use weapons to Israel to kill Palestinians? Why is everyone still trading with Israel? They don't trade with other countries. We've even got sanctions against Venezuela, who never did anything on us. We've obviously they sanctioned Russia after the start of the Ukraine war, and stupidly so. But I mean, they don't even want to hear about sanctioning Israel. The association agreement, which has a clause in it that human rights have to be respected in order for the association agreement conditions be met. And Israel, listen, the dogs in the street know that Israel doesn't give a damn about human rights, doesn't give a damn about the lives of Palestinians. They've shown it over and over and over. And it is so clear, it's so clear to people now that this is a deliberate attempt by Israel at ethnic cleansing. It's a deliberate genocide. And we have the Americans and the Europeans supporting a genocide.
And the Canadians. It must be said from the Canadians.
I know. I suppose, listen, there's other, all the settler colonialists do, right? The old colonial projects. You have the Brits, you have Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Those countries were formed on genocides themselves, right? Not the Brits. But America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand wiped out the indigenous people to form their country. That's a good few years ago now, and they got away with it. Well, Israel isn't going to get away with it. We're living in different times, and people are not going to take it anymore. The Palestinians are not going to take it. Some of their neighbors are not going to take it. Right now, the politicians of Europe are in the pocket of US empire. There's very few politicians at a serious level in Europe in power who are not pawns of US empire. And that's a big problem. And it's a huge problem for Europe in so many ways. So, yes, the Irish people are supportive of the Palestinians. The Irish government are not. But they get away with it a bit because the mainstream media helped them. And, oh, they say the right thing, but they do nothing. And that was actually pointed out by Francesca Albanese not so long ago. She actually criticised the Irish government for being all talk and no action. If you are actually sympathetic to the Palestinians, well, do something about it. And they're doing nothing, only talking. Talk doesn't stop a genocide. We've done nothing to stop the genocide, the same as everybody else in Europe has done nothing at the political level, have done nothing to stop the genocide. I mean, how in God's name are any of these people ever going to have the right to talk about humanitarian law, about human rights, anywhere else again? All anyone has to say to them, but you were supporting the genocide in Gaza. What are you on about? The EU was forever telling us that, oh, we really cared about women. Oh, God, we really care about women. Oh, the situation in Iran is terrible. Women don't. They have to wear the veil sometimes. They're not treated properly. Oh, Iran is a terrible regime. We must sanction Iran because they don't treat women properly. Right? There's tens of thousands of women being killed in Palestine, and they don't give a damn about them. Because we don't actually have give a damn about people elsewhere unless it suits our geopolitical agenda.
You have been an outspoken critic of the Ukrainian war, the policies of the EU with respect to the Ukrainian war. What is your view, Mick, about why that war began? How did it come about? What role, if any, did the West play in the provocation of that war?